whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no hollow heart, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul. Whatever thou be, until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
And I'm Lindsay.
You're Lindsay Lou. No announcements today. We're just going to get into it.
Not an announcement.
What kinds of listener tales do you have for us today, Lindsay Lou?
Well, Daniel, I have three tales this week, randomly all submitted by dudes.
Okay.
Which is kind of fun, just like a different, I try to mix it up, but these all felt great together. My first tale, we are going to have a little throwback to a possible Spearfinger sighting. Spearfinger is a tale that you told earlier this year. I'll reference it when we get into it.
Is it Cherokee? I can't remember.
We'll get into it later.
Okay.
Because I have it in here somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my second story, a possible time lapse, glitch in the matrix. How did I get here? Very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really freaked me out. And then my third story, a military-based story about what some guys saw on the watchtower.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to hearing those.
Yeah, it's fun to have like an all male perspective. Those stories definitely have a different tone.
Oh, all right. All right. I have two. They are both excellent.
No.
The first one comes from one of our researchers in a very personal way. A friend of hers told her this story, and it is creepy.
Is this from Molly?
Yep. What starts off looking like a bad case of sleep paralysis slash like, you know, very lucid dream, you know, nightmare, ends up appearing to be a very real case of an encounter with a pair of disturbing entities.
Okay.
And then my second story, a ghost story of sorts, begins back during the American Civil War. Despite taking place over 150 years ago, it was well documented by some local newspapers. I can't believe we hadn't heard of it before. It's not very well known.
Yeah.
But when you actually look into it, you're like, oh yeah, these old like newspaper archives.
Uh-huh.
There was a bunch of stuff back there, and it is really weird.
Okay.
Sad, scary, creepy, also maybe strangely comforting at the same time in certain ways.
Okay.
All wrapped up into the same tale.
Sure.
And I don't want to give anything else away. So when you're socked up and ready to roll.
Look at these socks. They're so funny.
Those are funny.
They have like little arms and little eyes. And it's what I love about it is that like if you're wearing them, because you guys know, guys, I start physical therapy tomorrow. So I might be able to put my foot back on the desk soon. But
it reminds me of the Swedish Chef Muppet a little bit, but like color. But just the eyes and the maybe like a skinny head.
Yeah. Well, what's funny about them? Oh, they're opposite. So I have one on already.
Uh-huh.
And on the other one, the eyes are on the back. So it's like one guy facing forward, one guy facing backwards.
They're looking out every direction.
Ooh,
keeping you safe.
Thank you.
Okay, so now that you're protected.
I'm protected.
Very little setup for this first story. All you need to know before getting into the story is that Molly claims it is 100% true. For the sake of the subject's privacy, she changed the name of his university. But besides that, everything I'm going to tell you, she says, really happened. It happened to Molly Box here at Bad Magic Productions. She was given the story firsthand and then cleaned it, you know, into a nice narrative for some extra spooks, but no horror details were added. And I'll just share it with you now. Time now for the tale of He Was Real. Jason was sleeping, or at least he thought he was. He had stayed up until around 2 a.m. that night playing video games, a luxury he could only afford in the off-season. The 20-year-old was a wide receiver for Colorado State University. The school's name has been changed, and so has his name. And during football season, he was forced to go to bed early after grueling evening workouts just so he could wake up early the next day for even more grueling morning practices. But now it was a spring, and Jason was taking full advantage of the freedom he had away from the team's rigid training schedule. Unlike his freshman year, when he shared a suite with three other sweaty dudes, this year Jason was lucky enough to get assigned a single-person dorm room, and he loved having his own space.
Mm-hmm.
With no housemates around to steal from it, he was finally able to get a mini fridge, keep it stocked with protein shakes and Bud Light, even had enough room to set up the TV directly in front of his bed, just where he liked it. This was and still is an unbreakable habit of his. Every night without fail, Jason turns on the TV and falls asleep to ESPN. While some people opt for the soothing rhythm of rainfall or whale songs, Jason prefers to drift off to the sound of sports commentators arguing over who is the real GOAT. Mm-hmm. This night, when he was done playing GTA, he switched the input of his trusty Roku to cable and went to bed under the glow of the bright TV screen. And like always, he fell asleep. Or again, so he thought. It felt like that eerie sort of sleep that lurks somewhere between conscious and unconscious, and disguises itself as both. The sort of sleep that makes your mind unfamiliar to you, and saturates it with a viscous, sedate concern that you can never quite place. At some point, Jason thought he was awake. He was almost sure of it. His body felt warm and tired and tangible. His memory foam mattress and threadbare cotton duvet felt normal on his skin, and illuminated by the flickering television, his room looked the same as it always did. Or did it? Jason felt like his mind was working in slow motion. The TV. Something was wrong. It was too bright. Blindingly bright. Unbearably bright. Jason wanted to look away to pull the covers up and shield his face from the insufferable glare, but he couldn't move. His body was numb to him. It was as if he didn't have a body at all. Perhaps he never did. Perhaps his arms and legs and torso and throat and face and skull were all just a dream, and now he's woken up. No, that couldn't be true. He was real. He was real. He was real. His mind raced. An oppressive panic smothered him. He couldn't think. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't... Wait. What channel did he leave the TV on? The screen was swimming with amorphous things. He didn't recognize them. Were they trying to get out? Jason felt like his brain was gasping for air, trying to find reason and clarity. He was real. He was real. This was a dream. Then the door to his dorm room opened. Someone was inside. Who? He lived alone. The door was locked, wasn't it? Jason saw the figure in his peripheral vision, walking towards his bed. It was coming for him. He tried to scream. He needed to scream. He needed to see the thing that was about to take him. He needed to fight. He needed to run. As the being drew closer, Jason could feel the numbness of his limbs slowly begin to thaw. Straining against the invisible force that paralyzed him, he tried to lift his neck. He could see it. It was standing at the end of his bed, directly in front of the glowing TV. It was shaped like a human, but it had no silhouette, no outline. The light from the television screen poured unobstructed through the translucent thing, as if it weren't there at all. But it was there. It was real. It was a man. Or it was once a man. Jason wrenched his mouth open to scream. His jaw cracked, but no sound came out. The entity did nothing. Moving the rest of his body was like trying to swim through wet cement. But the terror, the profound electric terror pulsing through his veins, fueled Jason's fight. With fury, the football player began to kick his tense legs at the shape, but his kicks were so slow, pathetic. His normally strong limbs, loaded with fast twitch muscle fibers, felt like they were being weighed down with miles and miles of heavy leaden chains. The translucent man still didn't move. Jason could now hear himself choking and screaming, "Fuck you! Fuck off! Get the fuck out of here!" Now it left. Jason woke up frantic in pitch black darkness. He was sweating. His heart was racing like he had just finished a workout. His jaw was sore, but he could move. He peeled the covers off his damp skin and stood up. He was in his dorm. The TV was off. That was alarming. He never turned the TV off. He grabbed the remote off the linoleum floor and clicked the button to change the channel. The old Roku immediately lit up with the familiar scene of some basketball player's highlights from the game earlier that evening. Jason stood there in the shadow of his nightmare, in the blaze of his television, surveying the familiar room around him. Everything was in its place. He went over to check the door. It was locked. Jason sighed with relief and returned to his bed. After chugging the rest of the half-empty orange Gatorade on his nightstand, he laid down and tried to fall back asleep to the comforting, familiar sounds of ESPN. Knock, knock, knock! Jason's eyes shot open. Someone was at the door. Tired anger flared inside of him. He had just been able to fall back asleep after what felt like hours of tossing and turning, and now there was some dumb drunk kid knocking on his door seeking refuge for the night because he was a moron and lost his dorm key. It was probably Brad from down the hall. Brad was an idiot. Jason stomped to the door, unlocked the automatic deadbolt, and yanked it open. It wasn't Brad. It wasn't even a college student. Jason felt his brain sink into his skull. He struggled to comprehend time unfold around him and the two figures standing in front of him. One was a little boy. He was blonde and pale and ordinary, maybe 10 or 11 years old. His face was blank. He stared up at Jason. There was nothing to the boy. He was nothing. But he was real, wasn't he? Jason now felt like he was driving in a prolific, opaque fog without headlights. He was lost. There was a man standing behind the little boy. He was massive. Although Jason is 6'3", he felt dwarfed by this giant. He had dark hair and the burly beard of a lumberjack and dreadful murky eyes eclipsed under a thick brow. Jason looked at them, then back at his bed. His neck felt like jello as he twisted his head on it. He became nervous his body might boil and melt and leave his skull to drown in a puddle of goo. No, that couldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. He was real. He was real. He was real. Someone was in his bed now. A man, it seemed. Perplexed, Jason tilted his head and squinted at the pile of body and cotton sound asleep where he should be. Jason felt jealous. He would like to be asleep. Knock! The little boy was still at the door, the man still behind him. Jason turned back around to face them. Do you guys need anything? Jason asked. The words he heard come out of his own mouth were far away and delayed, like it was an eternity between when he spoke and when his voice finally dissolved into sound. They just stared at him. Jason peered back over his shoulder at the man sleeping in his bed. He was gone. How could he be gone? He was real, wasn't he? Fear, solid, palpable fear took hold of him. He looked at the boy and the man. The little boy twitched. Jason grabbed the heavy door and slammed it shut. He expected to hear the loud clank of the automatic lock and dense door clicking securely into place, but all he heard was a sickening, dull, fleshy thud. His gaze was fixated at the little boy's skinny arm dangled between the door and the doorframe. Jason stared at it with abject horror. Was he hurt? There was no blood. No bruise. Just a bony forearm and a tiny, limp-wristed hand. Perhaps there was never a boy at all. Only his limbs. No, the little boy was real. He was real. Jason shook his head, trying to dislodge his thoughts from the crevices that had fallen into his brain. He looked down and screamed. Both of his hands were pressed flatly against the door, pushing it hard against the little boy's arm. Jason jerked his arms back in revulsion, fell onto the floor, pain surging through his body as it slammed against the linoleum. The world was quiet. Fluorescent light from the hallway beamed into his room. The door was wide open. The little boy and the giant man were standing there side by side, gazing vacantly down at him. Jason opened his mouth to beg for his life and sanity, but the words died in his throat when the little boy abruptly ran away. Jason could hear his tiny footsteps fade down the hallway, clatter down the stairs like marbles tumbling down, down, down. The giant man raised his arm. Jason braced himself for the strike. It never came. The just man just gently grabbed the handle and slowly pulled the door closed. The deadbolt clicked into place. Jason was in complete and utter darkness, save for the silver sliver of light peeking in from the hallway under the door. He could see the shadow of the man's feet there. Jason didn't move. He didn't breathe. Beads of sweat trickled down his brow and onto his eyelashes. His heart was pounding. He stared at the shadow under the doorway, waiting for it to disappear, willing the man to follow the little boy through the hall and down the cement stairwell into nothingness. Bam! The giant man slammed his fists against the door. The whole room shook. The linoleum floor fractured open a bit. Jason heard someone speaking to him. He turned around. He wasn't alone. Someone was in his bed. He was asleep. He must be. Or maybe he was dead? Dead and tired and buried in a cotton duvet, too grave-bound to be disturbed by violent knocks on heavy doors? A tall, indistinct figure was standing next to him now, staring down at the body in the bed. Please, Jason whispered. The tall figure turned his head. He stared at Jason. His eyes were blurry and immaterial, but he was real. Suddenly, his jaw dropped open. It dangled there, unhinged, as if it were making way for a terrible procession of screams. Bang! 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 From out of its cavernous mouth erupted the violent sound of someone pounding their fist against a heavy wooden door. Jason woke up. The next morning, Jason met his teammates for breakfast in the dining hall. He was groggy and exhausted, still felt a vague sense of dread left over from his bizarre series of what he thought were still dreams the night before. That's what they had to have been. That's all they were, dreams, vivid, terrible dreams. He was quiet that morning in the dining hall. Although he was mostly convinced that the previous night's horrors were just the work of his unconscious mind, he still couldn't think of anything else. He also didn't know how to explain any of it to his friends, so he just kept to himself in his pile of pancakes. But then one of his teammates, Brian, spoke up. Jason wasn't as close with Brian as he was with the other skill position players, but he knew the guy was a year older and a top recruit for defensive end. And Jason also knew that Brian lived in the same dorm as him, just on the other side of the massive building. Brian went on to tell them that the night before he couldn't sleep a wink because of what he thought were some drunk jerk-offs running up and down the hallway at 3 a.m. His girlfriend was there too, but she didn't seem all disturbed by the loud stampede outside their door and slept through the whole thing. Pissed off, Brian crawled out of bed to go yell at whoever was making all the noise, but when he swung open the door and stomped outside, he didn't find the hallway littered with blacked out sophomores like he'd been expecting. Instead, he saw just two people. A little boy. A giant, dark-haired man. He said he just shut the door, shrugged his shoulders, and went back to bed, but Jason could tell that these figures scared the hell out of Brian. And they certainly scared the hell out of him. Whatever they were no dream. They were real, they were real, they were real.
No resolution? You know how I feel about that.
Well, kind of. He had resolution in the sense that, like, wasn't a dream.
Well, yeah, but we don't know what they are.
We don't know what they are.
We don't know what happens next.
True.
Molly, call your old college friend.
Yes, and he doesn't know what happened next. Just that.
Well, he lived there. Like, did they come back more? Was it just a one-time thing?
He would have said.
I need to talk to Molly. I have questions.
I really like that. Because like when I was going through it first, I'm like, this is just a weird dream.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Yeah.
But like a weird dream. And then I was like, oh.
Yeah, because
Brian.
Brian, not Brad, could confirm it.
Yeah.
And also, like, and I think he said they were not in the same building.
They're in the same building, but like across the building from one another. And I think that was an important detail that they were in the same building.
I was thinking like building, like a U-shaped kind of building.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You know.
So in the middle of the night, they both saw these weird figures.
It's strange that it's a big man and a small child. Because for a second, I was like, oh no, it's a black-eyed kid.
I knew that when you reacted that way. I'm like, oh, she's thinking it's a black-eyed kid.
Yeah. But then when there's the guy standing behind him, maybe that's how you become a black-eyed kid.
Who knows?
Yeah. I guess you don't have any photos.
No, then. No photos. I do have a picture. No pictures associated with the story, but when I did an image search for creepy boy and man ghost,
okay,
the first three pics that came up were all of actor Ted Danson.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Gary Busey.
Nope, Ted Danson.
Okay.
Okay, so this is from the 1987 film Three Men and a Baby starring Danson.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Selleck, Steve Guttenberg.
I forgot about that movie.
And you can see that human shape in the window?
Yeah.
Well,
that little boy?
Yep. This shot led to an urban legend that part of the movie was filmed in a house haunted by the ghost of a boy who died in the house.
Oh, that kid's not supposed to be there?
It's not a kid, but Tom Selleck cleared this up in an interview. This was filmed on a soundstage, and the figure in the window is just a cardboard cutout of Ted Danson.
It sure is. The more you look at it, right. The more I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he played an actor in the movie named Jack Holden, and Jack had cardboard cutouts of himself all around the house. I just thought that was kind of funny.
That is funny.
That it led to like internet lore. It's like, oh, this was filmed. And it's like, no, that's just a cardboard cutout in the window of Ted Danson from the movie.
Ah, that's great. Oh, just the one photo?
Yeah, just that one
photo. Oh, when you said the first three, I thought it was going to be three.
You said
the first three photos were of Ted Danson. So I thought it was going to be...
Yes. Yeah, the first three that came up. Yeah, were all that. Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Funny. I forgot about that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was huge.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Three Men and a Baby. And then there was like...
There was a sequel or two.
Three Men and a Toddler. Or Three Men... There were like... There was another three.
I know. I can't remember.
I know. And it was like a very stupid... But I remember being allowed to watch that movie at some point, and I thought I was very mature. Because for a while, my parents wouldn't let me watch it.
Sure.
I don't know why.
Too little.
Well, you know. Okay.
So you ready to leave behind Molly's friend and head to a very creepy ghost story set in Indiana?
Yeah, let's go.
Before we move on to more scares, we need to take a quick in-between story sponsor break. Please take advantage of these sponsor deals and use our codes and landing pages so you save money and we keep getting sponsored.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
There's a story behind every murder. But is there an ending? That's the question being asked by Murder True Crime Stories, a Crime House original podcast powered by Pave Studios. I'm Carter Roy. Join me every Tuesday as I tell the story of a famous solved or unsolved murder. Each episode dives into the darkest corners of true crime, unraveling chilling narratives, examining compelling clues, and most importantly, seeking the truth. What sets Murder True Crime Stories apart is the focus on humanizing the victims and the effect their deaths had on their families, friends, and community will always leave with the knowledge of why their stories need to be heard. New episodes release every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Murder: True Crime Stories.
Thanks for listening to our Deals, Creeps, and Peepers. Hope you heard something you like. Okay, decent amount of historical setup before we get into the spooks of the story. It really starts to build about halfway through.
Okay.
So for this one, we're headed back to the Civil War era America to explore the origin story of one of the most haunted houses in Indiana, an unassuming two-story brick home that sits atop Medora Hill in Jackson County, Indiana. The house was built in 1843 by Dr. Creed Wilson for his wife, Sophia Douglas Wilson, and their infant son, Aesop. They were a well-to-do family, and wanting the best for his beautiful wife and darling baby boy, Creed spared no expense constructing what back then was considered a fairly luxurious abode. According to one 1935 Jackson County Banner article, the designer Creed, hired to furnish his estate, brought fine furniture from Louisville, Kentucky, and Cincinnati, and imported Persian rugs, a fancy hanging kerosene lamp for the living room, and other knickknacks that went to make a cold building of brick and wood a home. Despite Creed's efforts to imbue the place with warmth, the flicker of joy that once flared in the lone home on Medora Hill quickly died out, and a cold, gruesome, malevolent entity moved in. Time now for the tale of a mother's love. Sophia Douglas Wilson begged her son not to enlist. Like all good patriotic mothers in polite company, she spoke exuberant words of praise for all the young boys fighting for the Union. But in the quiet privacy of her Indiana home, she declared freely that all those brave young Union soldiers were marching towards nothing more than their own graves. She told her son Aesop just as much. But the near certainty of early and gruesome death didn't seem terrifying to the young man. It seemed honorable. War to him meant heroism. Sophia tried to appeal to the side of her son and argued that honor bound him not to the battlefield, but to his home, where he had a responsibility to take care of his mother and his father, Dr. Creed Wilson. Of course, this fell on deaf ears. And when President Abraham Lincoln called for 75,000 volunteers to join the army in April of 1861, Aesop Wilson was more than ready to answer the call. Without a word to either of his parents, in the dead of night, June 11th, 1861, Aesop enlisted in the Union Army and was sent to Jefferson City, Missouri to join the rest of Indiana's 22nd Regiment. Aesop departed his childhood home to fulfill his glorious duty and defend his homeland. And if destroying the enemy would bring his death, so be it. He just hoped he could take a few Confederates down with him, thought the 18-year-old. After he enlisted, Aesop sent letters regularly to his parents to let them know he was okay. But only one ever reached them. On September 21st, 1861, Aesop wrote from War Eagle, Missouri, "Mother, I write you a few short lines to let you know that I am well, fat, ragged, and sassy. We are now on the War Eagle, one of Uncle Sam's boats, on our way from Boonville to Jefferson City. We left Jeff City Wednesday night and ran up to Glasgow, about 100 miles from Jeff City, where we was landing and sent out some troops to attack a succession battery. This will probably be the last time I will write you, for the mail does not come up as far as our camp. We have been having a hell of a time lately. 15 minutes notice is all we get of marching orders. I have traveled nearly 600 miles now, and I have the first Confederate to see yet. The old boat is running over logs, stumps, and everything else, so we will have to close. Uncle Sam's Aesop." Exactly 1 month later, on October 21st, 1861, he died. Unfortunately, it was not the magnificent death he imagined for himself. He wasn't killed, saving a comrade's life on the battlefront, or struck down by a Confederate bullet only after striking 10 of their own. No, Aesop's short life came to a far less glamorous end. He died of typhoid fever. By the time his parents were informed of their son's passing in January of 1862, the boy had already been buried somewhere in Missouri. Dr. Creed Wilson was eventually able to get in touch with a relative he knew in the area, who tracked down the boy's body to a Methodist church graveyard in Boonville. The relative, Mr. Gray, then sent a letter to Creed and Sophia. "I found your son's grave," he wrote. "His name is marked on the footboard with a lead pencil. Apply to John Macular, the church's sexton, and there is no doubt that you can find the grave at any time you come to get the body of your son." Though Aesop's parents never came to Missouri themselves, in April of 1862, they had their son's body disinterred and shipped back to Indiana in a metal casket. Dr. Wilson wanted the boy's corpse to be sent straight to their local graveyard, where they could honor him with a proper burial and service. But Sophia refused. She didn't believe the boy in the metal coffin was really her son. She believed, with a fierceness that worried friends and neighbors, that her son was still alive somewhere. There had been some absurd mistake. So she requested the metal coffin be shipped directly to their home. When it finally arrived with commanding certainty, Sophia demanded the undertaker who delivered the casket to open it up. Because he knew she would never consent to the burial until she saw her son's face, Creed told the undertaker to do as his wife asked. Slowly, the metal casket was pried open, revealing a shriveled, decomposing body inside. Though the Civil War did usher in the new practice of embalming bodies, Aesop himself had not been preserved. So instead of waxy and petrified, the boy's corpse looked decayed and ravaged. After all, he had been rotting for 7 months, first in a cheap coffin, haphazardly shoved into the earth, then transported like common cargo in a metal shipping container across state lines, and now once again being exposed to the world of the living for his mother to examine. An odor that made Creed cover his nose erupted from the metal box. But still, Sophia leaned in. She surveyed the body, the muscle flesh detached and dangling from grimy bare bones, the internal tissue visibly soft and mushy, the whole of him a nauseating brownish hue, his stomach oddly bloated and large. The room was silent. She reached down into the metal casket and ran the back of her hand along her son's discolored and deteriorating face. After what felt like hours, she snapped back up and turned to the undertaker. In a calm voice, she told him, "Please go and retrieve some charcoal to be placed in the coffin with my son. And when you return here, do so with a few other men, as I would like you to then take him upstairs to my sitting room so we may enjoy this fine afternoon together." The undertaker didn't know what to say. He looked to Creed for guidance, but the doctor seemed just as paralyzed. So, not seeing any other options, he simply nodded and left to go gather some coal. Embalming encased dead bodies by packing charcoal around them is an ancient Egyptian burial technique, and though it was not particularly popular during this period, it also wasn't entirely unheard of. The undertaker did as he promised, and that very afternoon, the coal-filled metal coffin, was lugged up the stairs and shimmied into the study where Sophia, calmer than her husband could ever imagine her to be in a situation like this, directed the men where to place it, like she was deciding where to hang a new painting on the walls. When they leaned the coffin upright against the wall next to the window, a sickening thud heard from inside the coffin caused one of the men to mumble under his breath, "Jesus Christ!" The sound of her son's decaying body lurching against coal and metal didn't seem to faze Sophia. "Wonderful!" she said, her eyes fixed, unblinking on the casket. "What a superbly comfortable place for he and I to enjoy this afternoon." The room was silent for a nauseating few minutes while Sophia continued to stare at the death box. None of the men moved. None knew what to say. They wanted to protest, but to what end? What good would it do? They simply watched and waited for the mad woman to do whatever she would do next. To their horror, with her eyes still boring into the casket, her mouth suddenly erupted into an empty grin. Without looking in their direction, she told the undertaker and his men, "Thank you for your help. If you'll excuse us, Aesop and I are in desperate need of some quality mother-son time. You can leave the door unlocked behind you." They were more than happy to oblige and left the woman to her dead son's corpse without another word. Creed had adjourned to the kitchen and into his whiskey bottles as soon as they started hoisting the casket up the stairs and hadn't been seen since. Upon their departure, he stumbled to the base of the stairwell, gripping a nearly empty bottle in his hand. "Sophia!" he yelled. Silence. "Sophia!" he screamed again. "Sophia!" Nothing. Finally, he chucked the bottle onto the floor, bombing the hardwood with 1,000 shards of broken glass, and stomped upstairs. The door to the study was shut. He was boiling over with disgust and grief and fury, and it took all of what little strength he had left not to break it down. Sucking in stale air through his gritted teeth, he gently took a hold of the knob and opened the door. When he saw the scene inside, he let out a whimper. Sophia was sitting in a faded yellow lounge chair facing the window and speaking quiet words in a pleasant voice, as if she was talking to a fellow parishioner at church on Easter Sunday. Her right hand held an empty teacup, and with her left she was softly stroking the metal casket, as if it was the arm of a lover. Creed didn't know if it was seconds or minutes or hours after he walked in, but eventually Sophia peered over her shoulder at him. She was smiling. And he screamed. Her face was sunken, rotted, collapsed in upon itself like a moldy orange, shriveled and sick. Her eyes were jelly, her teeth were black, her grin vile and ripped. She spoke, her voice was sweet and calm. "Come here, darling," she coaxed. "Our boy has returned a war hero, and this is the greeting you give him." Creed, his mind burning with nothing but fear, began to back into the open doorway. Sophia stood, and while keeping her dissolving eyes on him, she began walking to her cowering husband. Again she spoke, but now it wasn't her voice. "Hey, Pops, I missed you. Don't you want to hear about the front lines?" His son's voice cooed from Sophia's septic and festering mouth, a voice that the mourning father thought he would never hear again. Creed stumbled backwards out of the doorway and onto the hallway floor, devastating horror and awe suffocating his insides. He disintegrated into a fit of agonizing sobs and screams. His wife towered above him.
Shh. Everything's going to be all right, my love.
Creed slowly raised his head to meet the madwoman's gaze. The decay that riddled her face just moments before was gone. She looked exactly like she had every day since Aesop had enlisted, pale, drained, hollow, but alive. Only now a lifeless grin was speckled onto her fatigued face. Sophia knelt low to caress her husband's head with her soft hands, just as she did to her son's decomposing face mere hours before.
"It's all right, my love," she whispered. "Our son is home."
Creed watched as she stood up and walked back into the study. In the doorway of the room, Sophia paused for a moment, staring at the metal casket by the window. Then, with her back to her terrified husband, crumpled on the floor, she reached for the door behind her and swung it violently closed. For 12 years, Sophia Douglas Wilson kept her son's dead body by the window.
What?
12 years. By the window of her second floor study. And for those 12 years, the devoted mother spent her mornings, afternoons, and nights amiably conversing with her precious baby boy. Of course, rumors of the ridiculous mad woman on Medora Hill immediately inundated the small town, and neighbors would snicker and laugh as the old woman talked to a casket in the window. But soon, those who made fun of her began to fear her instead. As the months and years wore on, through the second floor window of the house on Medora Hill, which was in full view of anyone who walked by, neighbors and curious townsfolk no longer just saw Sophia Wilson talking to herself in a metal casket. They saw other people, or more accurately, other things in the study with her, glowing white wraiths standing behind the woman and her dead son looking through the window at whoever was looking back. They saw Sophia Wilson's face change, and not just with age. One moment, the mother in the window looked as normal as a woman storing a casket in her study could, and the next, her face would appear mutilated and sick, just as Creed saw that very first afternoon. In moments like these, when death infested Sophia's face, even from the street, you could see the bile dribbling over her decaying lips and malevolent smile, and no matter how far you stood from the house, you could make out the putrefied tendons and spoiled insides behind her rotting skin. Friends and neighbors also reported that if you were to walk past the Wilson residence while Sophia was having one of her afternoon chats with her dead son, you could hear their conversation. As clearly as if you were in the study, you could hear the syrupy, sweet, exceedingly affectionate things Sophia was telling her dead son, as well as the sorrowful sound of Aesop's spirit begging his mother to release him. His mother, however, never seemed to hear her son's desperate pleas. That was until 1873, when she finally did release the boy. That year, after more than a decade of suffering as his wife hoarded their son's dead body and festered in the study with horrors he didn't care to know or even acknowledge, Creed Wilson found a way to get Aesop's corpse out of the house and hopefully his wife back to sanity. For $50, he hired two spiritualist mediums, Mr. and Mrs. Kegwin from Louisville, Kentucky, to come host a seance in his home. The Jackson County Banter reported on the event, saying that Mr. and Mrs. Kegwin arrived during a gloomy afternoon and arranged for a seance that night. Curious neighbors, bonnets and hats pulled over their eyes, trudged through the heavy rain to gather at the home as soon as darkness fell. After a long, terrifying pause, Mrs. Huffington, a local who attended the seance, says a muffled voice, dim and faint, can be heard in the next room, seeming to hover over the pale form of Mrs. Wilson. Mrs. Wilson, trembling with emotion, and certain it was the voice of her son, asked, "Who is this talking?"
"This is Aesop, mother," replied the voice.
"I can barely hear you. Why don't you talk louder?" asked Mrs. Wilson, tears running down her cheeks.
"It is damp and rainy outside, and I cannot get nearer," replied the voice.
The article goes on to say that after a while, Sophia eventually asked the disembodied voice if he would like his remains to be buried.
"Yes, mother," it replied.
"Where?" she questioned.
"In the cedars just north of the house," replied the voice.
Aesop's remains were buried, at long last, the very next day. Creed died 2 years later. 2 years after that, Sophia died as well. Although she requested to be buried in the cedars next to her son, her body was instead placed next to her husband at the family cemetery in Leesville. They named no heirs to inherit the home, so as the decades passed, the haunted house of Medora Hill and the boy buried in the backyard became overrun with weeds and rot. That was until 1926, when U.S. Highway 50 was built and Aesop's remains were disinterred and moved to an unknown plot of land in order to make room for the new pavement. The house remained abandoned for 32 more years until it sold and turned into the Medora Interdenominational Christian Mission Church. According to one Columbus Herald article from 1959, the process of clearing the property for the House of God actually began in July of 1958, exactly 100 years after the original house was built. Although the original house is now gone, Creed and Sophia dead, and Aesop's body no longer imprisoned on the grounds, the land that once held the Medora haunted house is still exactly that, haunted. But that will have to be if we choose to tell it a story for another time.
Knew it. Knew it would still be haunted. Aesop's got some things to say.
Yeah, there's a bunch of interesting news articles from like back when this was going on. Just, you know, concerned neighbors and...
Yeah.
I mean, a dozen years.
A dozen years. Here's the thing. I love you so much and I love our kids so much.
Yeah.
I'm not hanging out with your casket.
No.
Outside of your funeral?
Yeah.
That's about it, buddy.
Yeah.
I'll miss you. I'll cry every day. I'll look at pictures of you.
Yeah.
I'll wear your clothes around the house. I'll be the Mrs. Haversham of Coeur d'Alene, but like...
Yeah.
Nope.
Oh.
Nope.
Well, go ahead.
Nope. Just lots of nopes.
This led me to an interesting thing I found on the internet. In 1 second, that'll be the third thing. First, just two pictures related to this story. They're both from the Jackson County Banner, Wednesday, January 23rd, 1935. They wrote about this story. That's a picture of Sophia Douglas Wilson.
Okay. Just fairly normal, you know.
Uh-huh. Doesn't look too happy, but a lot of people didn't in pictures back then.
She also looks like she has a cleft palate.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps, yeah. And then this next one, a picture of the Wilson family home on Medora Hill, also published in that same edition.
Okay.
Just, you know, fairly normal house. Now, this story made me curious about other parents keeping the bodies of their children with them.
Oh, gosh.
I found a 2013 Daily Mail article. This is the crazier story about a woman in the country of Georgia who had so far kept her grown 22-year-old son's body in her cellar for 18 years.
18 years.
Mm-hmm. Changing his clothes every year on his birthday.
Oh, God, honey.
Pickling him in alcohol.
Oh, baby.
For the first 10 years, she put a fresh alcohol-soaked sheet on his body literally every day.
Oh.
So that when his son, this is why she did this, when her grandson, his son, was fully grown, he could see what his father looked like as a grown man. She explained, he wanted his kid to see him that way. I believe from that point on, the kid started to love his father. She also had a little viewing window in the basement installed so family, friends, and passersby could look in on his remains. Apparently, at least back in 2013, he still looked pretty good for a corpse. She mummified him exceptionally well, even though he had started to decay in recent years. When asked how she learned to do that, she said, one night I had a dream when a voice told me to treat Joni by rubbing alcohol. So from then on, I've been using wet sheets dipped in alcohol to preserve the body. You must not leave the body without the sheets overnight, as the skin will turn black as charcoal. She added, for 10 years, I had been changing his clothes on his birthday. Over the past 4 years, I was unable to do so. She added, he was a good man, a good husband, not the way he is now, of course.
Yeah.
Starting in 2009, Joni, whose cause of death is unknown, finally began to decompose since illness prevented his mother from giving him daily care. She said, I was sick lately and could not tend to his body. That had an effect on him. My son is handsome. When I use the sheets, his skin will be white again and everything will be normal.
Okay.
Wow, she went mad with grief.
Well, I was just going to say, mad with grief. Now, okay, I watched my aunt bury her son.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a tragic accident in our family. It was so terrible, awful. And I was in the fourth grade, so about, what, 11? 11?
Fourth 11, grade, 12, no, I think younger,
10
maybe
or 11.
10 or 11.
And it's just, you know, it is.
Maybe even 9, yeah.
Well, I was thinking 10, 11, no, I was 10.
Okay.
I was 10. Mad with grief is exactly the phrase. And it was, you know, devastating to watch her. I mean, obviously the loss was so sad, but like it was almost worse watching her in the last day of the wake. She tried to crawl in the casket with him. I mean, it was so awful. So while I can't understand, I can certainly sympathize with what could happen. Now let's move on to like a different angle. Is that legal? Like, can you just have a dead body?
I guess in the country of Georgia, wherever she lived, I mean,
you couldn't do that here, could you?
No, I don't think you could.
I know it's not abuse. I know she's caring for the corpse, but it's like, I think there's
desecration of a corpse. There are like these random, there are like, you can't, the short answer. I just can't remember the name of the charges, but no, you can't just legally keep corpses in your home.
Man.
And I think those laws go back to like, you know, like health reasons.
Well, yeah, it's not clean, sanitary.
Yeah.
The smell, I imagine disease eventually, like just from the rotting.
Yeah, and like you said, the smell. I mean, you know, it's like if your neighbor, I mean, just imagine if it was legal and you're living in an apartment building.
Oh, my God.
And the people in the unit above you have like two dead bodies in their house.
Or just one. One's enough.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why it had to be two.
Well, I was thinking even more stink. Yeah.
Man. And there's just that dedication. So it's like, is she getting up in the morning, putting this like alcohol soaked sheet on him and then just going inside, taking a shower, going to work. There's no way.
No, she lost her mind.
She lost her mind. And then what a strange thing. Like, I wanted my grandson to see him. It's like, what year was this? I think we have pictures.
It was 2013 that the article came out.
Right. And he had been like that for 12 years.
I can pull it back.
So it was like 2001.
Or whatever I said before.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, we had cameras. We didn't have cell phone, like we didn't have iPhones, but like, my God.
I think it was longer than, because the first one was 12 years.
Oh, 18 years.
Yeah.
But even still, we're not talking about like a time when photographs didn't exist. So as to say.
Yeah, 18 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So as to say, like, she would have had photographs of her son. She didn't need their, I mean, I know she's just mad with grief. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. There's nothing logical, but
exactly.
Like, my God.
And it's
where's the rest of the family to be like, honey?
Well, and she says she's like doing this for her grandson. I'm like,
that's so creepy.
So traumatizing.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
You're not watching The Chancellor, but there is a strange scenario about a dead body in The Chancellor. And that's all I could think while you were telling. I was like, oh my God, daddy.
Yeah, Monroe and I are watching just really quick From.
Oh yeah.
And we're only 5 episodes in, but we both really like it.
Yeah, I've been catching bits and pieces of it just because I've been in the kitchen, like putting dishes away and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I've been picked up on some things and it feels like The Leftovers with like,
it has
like a
horror.
Certain, like a sci-fi horror.
Yep.
Yeah, what I've caught is really good.
Yeah, yeah. I like
Kate and I started that on your recommendation. And
oh, nice.
Do you like it?
Well. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Interesting mystery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I prefer that kind of horror.
Mm-hmm. And it has some good like jump scare horror thrown
definitely,
in as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But I prefer that like
more cerebral or.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it when there's like a better plot line and I mean, I'll watch it like a slasher, but that doesn't scare me. I'm just like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not really. It doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. This one has a good mix of different like horror elements where, it is like more cerebral and just like what's going on and like, you know, just like some creepy moments.
Yeah.
And then mixed in with almost more like a, not zombie, but like
kind of
body
dead
horror.
Vibes.
Yeah. Like a slasher kind of horror. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It can be gory moments.
Yeah. But not overdone.
There's a couple scenes you haven't. Where it can get real gory.
Okay. Well, what I saw, I was like, okay, tastefully done.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Are you ready to get cozy with Layla? Oh, okay. Red Layla.
Yeah.
I see Crochella laying over there and I feel like she's face down and I just.
She is.
She is not
she was
happy
napping.
About that.
She was napping.
She likes to nap on her back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know
okay.
That. Yeah. She doesn't like to be face down.
Okay, great.
It's hard for her to breathe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, because I like to give feelings to inanimate objects. All right, here we go. As a reminder, this is going to take us back to the legend of Spearfinger.
Yes.
Hey guys, so I was listening to this week's episode this morning and almost had to stop the car from shock. Dan started on the Spearfinger story, and though I'd never heard it before, I know this area in question very well. So Spearfinger episode, for those of you listening, you can go back to the February 6th episode, Do You Believe Now?, which has been like a new fan favorite from the fan story, Do You Believe Now?
Yeah.
And the Spearfinger legend is a figure from Cherokee folklore.
Okay, so what's Cherokee? Okay, I thought so, but yeah.
Yeah, okay, so the area is Nantahala and the Fontana Lake area, situated along historic Route 28 better known as Moonshiner 28, which then connects to Highway 192, better known as the Tail of the Dragon, further up the road at Deals Gap, North Carolina. This area backs up to the Smoky Mountain National Park. These roads are super popular amongst sports car owners and motorcycle riders, as they offer some of the best driving roads in the entire country. The area is also known for several deaths every year of motorcycle riders who meet their unfortunate fate on those very turns. Enter my story. We go to the area several times a year with our race cars, Corvettes, Porsches, etc. We spend days up in the mountains just running up and down these roads, driving spiritedly, and enjoying the natural beauty of the area. Last fall, I went down a few days early to check a few more roads off the bucket list that we wouldn't have time to get into later that week. My first day there, it was getting late, and I had some ground to cover to get to where I was staying the night in Tellico Plains before meeting friends in the morning. I had been north near Oak Ridge, Tennessee, driving some roads on what they called the Devil's Triangle. Quickest way would have been the highway, but despite the fact I'd been crammed in a Corvette for 8 long hours, I figured I was there to drive, so why not make a pass through the Dragon and out the Skyway for a pretty evening drive with some fun corners. I got to the Dragon at about 6:15. It was late enough, most of the riffraff was gone, and I knew it was going to be a good, clean run. I came up on a Porsche 911 with local tags, and I knew he was about to let it rip too. We start rolling through the turns pretty good. I was keeping up, but just barely, when suddenly we come around this particularly hard switchback and I saw the Porsche stuff the brakes. I caught a glimpse of what I can only describe as a black blob barreling down the hill towards the Tennessee River. It all happened pretty quickly. I just assumed that what I'd seen was a bear. That made sense. But after that, the Porsche decided to chill on the throttle, and we drove calm until we got to Deal Gap at the end of the Dragon. The Porsche pulled over, so of course I was curious about the bear, and I pulled in behind him. As we got out, he looks at me and he goes, "Dude, what the fuck? Did you see that shit?" "Oh yeah, the bear? Yeah, that was nuts. Good save, bro." But he says, "That wasn't a bear. It was... I don't know what it was." I kind of blankly stared at him, and I think he realized how crazy he sounded, but I could see on his face he was really shook up. He gained his composure a little bit and explained what happened a bit better. What he saw was what appeared to be some sort of humanoid figure that ran out in front of him, proceeded to scream at him, and then rolled into a ball and down the hill. I verified that I too saw the black blob rolling, but it looked like a bear to me. The car wasn't hit whatsoever, and it didn't make any contact, but I decided to go back up anyways to see if I could see anything. Nothing at all. No fur, no skid marks, just an empty road that was way too quiet for a place that's normally filled with the chaotic screams of sports bikes and race cars. I decided to get the fuck out. My ride to Tellico was slow, and I didn't think much of it, just wrote it off as the guy not knowing what he saw. But then I heard Dan's story, and it popped back into my head. Was it a bear? Did this guy see some sort of cryptid, or hell, maybe even Spearfinger? I don't know, but at any rate, I'm not sure I want to wander out there late at night again. It's freaky enough with no cell service on a road that claims lives every year, but add a paranormal factor into that, and nope, I'll stick to the daytime runs with a crew of people. Interesting.
God, I just bringing up cryptid, you know, Jamie Jean. Our friend, the story I told you the last week or the week before about the, it was in Alabama.
Highway 5.
And the girl who started hitchhiking walking back after prom or whatever like that. And then he was talking about, he's like, "You got to look into," and I'd have to grab my phone. But it's there was another popular story. He'd heard that story about the girl, Highway 5.
Jamie is from Alabama.
But it's a commonly, reported thing out there as what some cryptid. And then I looked into that cryptid. It's just crazy how many little, not even regional. It could be local to a county or a town or whatever, but just all these legends of creatures that look a little bit like a bear or look a little bit like a mountain lion, but not really, or like a man crossed with a bear or whatever. Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. I always think skinwalker when it's a combo of animal human, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I like that. I just imagine this crew of friends that goes cruising their cars, racing, whatever. It's that's the last thing you'd expect to see. And quite frankly, one of the last things you'd want to see.
Yeah.
Because hello, fucking swerve. That's really, really scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good story.
I liked it as well. You ready?
I am.
Okay, let's go. Hello, Dan and Lindsay. Been a fan for a hot minute listening to Time Suck and Scared to Death.
Thank you.
Starting with the opioid suck back in 22.
Oh, yeah.
This story is less of a get the fuck out and more of a what in the colorful fuck just happened. Back in 2021, my family took a road trip to New Mexico. I was road tripping a day behind them because I had school. I have this thing with road trips where I refuse to go on highways because I like to take in the scenery. This means my trip was 13 hours from Pittsburgh, Texas to Cloud Croft, New Mexico. I'd been driving for about 6 hours and my fuel light had been on for a questionably long time. I started scanning the roadside signs for a nearby gas station. On a stretch of Highway 380 between Claremont and Post, Texas, I rolled into some thick fog suddenly and was barely able to see more than a few feet in front of me. I saw lights emitting off of a structure, and as I drove closer, I could see a sign with a big red star, Texaco. This one is weirdly old school, retro looking, but that's not out of place for the middle of nowhere. I pull up to the pump, and as I'm about to hop out, some dude scares the crap out of me. He stuck his head through my window. What can I do for you, sir? Cigar hanging out of his mouth in that upbeat customer service kind of tone. I'm utterly confused. In the state of Texas, self-service pumps are the norm. I ain't never seen one of these things before. Must be one of them late models. You want the expensive stuff, I'm guessing, the guy chirps. Yeah, sure. The expensive stuff for my 22-year-old Toyota. He jumps to the back of the truck and pulls out a nozzle from the pump labeled unleaded. He's back to my window. Want me to look under the hood for you? In that same customer service tone. Sure, I guess, I muttered despite being very unsure. I popped the hood and I can hear him muttering, shit, I never seen this before. Growing uneasy, I glance at my phone. It's dead, despite the 70% battery I had not too long ago. Excuse me, sir. The guy is back at my window. Didn't see much on the engine, but your front tires were low, so I already filled them up for you. The pump clicks and he disappears. A second later, he reappears. All right, sir, that'll be $11.73. Gas is getting expensive these days, ain't it? I hand him $11.73 in various coins from my ashtray of coin, leave with a full tank of gas. As I pull away, the fog that covered everything dissipates. I glance out my rearview mirror and I can't see the Texaco sign. I pop a U-turn and turn back, disturbed by this discovery. There's nothing, not even a sign of the building's existence. My phone lights up with a million notifications from the last 30 minutes from my mother and various family members. I call my mom and she answers with a big sigh of relief. Apparently, she was watching me on Life 360 and saw my icon just stopped in the middle of nowhere. They were frantically calling and texting me to check on me. I reassured them I was fine, but did not tell them what had just happened. They would have surely passed it off as me being imaginative. Non-believers, am I right? I, too, would also say it was just my imagination, but every second of it felt so real. From the greasy gas station smells, to the humid feeling of really thick fog, to that guy's cigar breath. And that full tank of gas I got for $12 was definitely real. It got me to Cloudcroft in the end. I told my grandpa, who has driven nearly every square inch of the state highways of Texas. He told me of his own similar experience back in the 80s. Apparently, random spots in the middle of nowhere, Texas, do be like that sometimes. Felt like I was talking to Monroe.
I know, yeah.
Do be like that.
That's interesting about the gas.
Uh-huh. It's like a very real... It reminds me of that fan story of the hotel.
Yes. I love that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was a great story. And then they like come back and the hotel's just gone. It was never there.
But they no had one remembers the receipt. It.
Right. Not only do they have the memories of being there, the two of them.
Yeah.
But an actual receipt.
I know. Go ahead.
Like some kind of like space-time dimensional slippage.
Yeah.
Like you slip into like a parallel universe. I mean, we were just talking about that show From.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of a little bit of that too.
Oh, there's some of that in that show?
Well, I don't want to like spoil it from people, but mm-hmm. just this concept of... You're in this world and then you're driving along and then you go to a place that like nobody else knows about that shouldn't be there, but you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, it's just so terrifying. This poor person, I mean, he was alone. I'm like, that mm-hmm. would scare the shit out of me. But yeah, he walked away with like he had a tank of gas. If nothing
right,
else.
Right.
$11.73 for a tank of gas. Also, like as soon as I got to that part, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a time lapse. Like there's a weird... Because nobody's getting a full tank of gas for $12. That's not Is that possible?
Right, right. Yeah, that's another good story. I like those little like quick weird ones. That one reminded me almost of like Twilight Zone.
Yeah, with like this like very specific character. You can kind of picture him too.
Uh-huh. And the smell, right? Didn't he smell of a cigar?
Uh-huh. Like just all like the greasy smell of a gas station. I know exactly what he means. Just like, you know, oily.
Sights, smells, sounds, you know, tactile, touches, and then like taking a physical thing from it.
Yeah, and he definitely gave him $11.73.
Right, so right.
There's also that. Like, you know, you get to where you're going and you're, what he called it, a coin, ashtray of coin. It was just, you know, it's missing 12 bucks. Like, that's pretty noticeable.
That would be such an amazing experience to have with somebody. I mean, like if, okay, if it wasn't just you. Mm-hmm, like, let's say you and I are on a road trip and we're driving around and we go to some, I don't know, yeah, just the same thing, like some gas station.
Right.
Along the way. Yep, you just see it, you know, you pull over, doing like a little, like not necessarily the freeway, but like a little highway.
Yeah.
And you pull over this gas station and then you, let's say like in this example of you and I, we get to the next town and once we're there, it just comes up conversationally like, hey, how's your trip in to some bartender, waitress?
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, it was really cool. We stopped at a fun little gas station about, you know, 2 hours back down the road or whatever, half an hour. And she's like, are you sure? Half an hour? I'm like, yeah, it's in this town, like blah, blah, blah. And they're like, that's not a place. And then you go on the map and you look and it's just not there, but it's not just you, like you and the person you're with, that would alter change the course of your life potentially.
Absolutely. Well, and the fact that like this guy's family could see him on like Life 360 is like Find My. So it's like, you just see this blip.
And it stopped moving for a while, right?
He was just stuck in one spot in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And like, of course, I mean, as a parent, as a friend, you're just like, oh my God, they're being robbed. They're being murdered. They've broken down. They're broken down and they don't have service.
Right.
And the fact that his phone, he had 70% battery and then got off the freeway to get gas and his phone's just dead.
That's so weird. Like, yeah.
Like it just drained so much.
That's almost like some alien abduction.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just thinking of like these aliens who really don't want you to know what happened and they actually put gas in your vehicle and put this false memory in your head.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Could be.
Weird.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it felt like 30 minutes for him sitting there, you know, or like his family could verify for 30 minutes, like getting gas doesn't take 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess also I didn't realize this, but he lost time.
And that's that, like, again, you know, whenever these things come up in stories, I think of simulation theory.
Yeah.
Where it's like the little glitch in the Matrix. You know, this little video game we're inside, you know, just glitches for a little bit.
Freaks me out.
Good voices, too. That's really fun narration.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
My face hurts so bad, you guys. I have such a dry face. My face hurts.
Oh, boy.
I know. And I can't like, oh, God. I just like feel like my face crumbling. I'm like, okay. Okay.
I was picturing your face.
Just like falling off.
Well, the lady in my second story.
Oh.
Like it just starts looking like it's rotting and falling, but then you snap back and it's regular.
It would be so cool if I could do that in the middle of a story.
It would be cool. It would be great for our show, actually.
It would be great to watch you lose your shit.
Yeah, but then people would be like, oh, it's just CGI.
But
isn't that crazy about today, actually? Like if that happened, okay, we're on the show. We're getting filmed. That happens in, looks very realistic, in 19, I don't know, 60 or somewhere where like there's good definition, but, you know, practical effects or whatever, like there is
special
no CGI,
effects,
special effects haven't advanced yet. Because then it would freak people out.
Yeah.
Now you could legitimately have the most terrifying experience ever. And then, AI.
Yeah.
CGI.
You'd have to start murdering me or something. Like something really aggressive would have to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a deep fake.
God. All right. Ready? One more?
Yeah.
All right. This story is called What We Saw on Tower Watch. I was pretty used to the military life, but not deployment life. I was 3 years in at the time and a newly promoted sergeant on my first combat deployment ever. It started halfway through my tour in Afghanistan. Because we were undermanned, I was put on Tower Watch detail with a good friend and a good soldier. One particular night, a night I'll never forget. Tower Watch that night was like any other. Calling out convoys, target locations, and filling out range cards. Usual, boring stuff. Around 10 p.m., we were doing the usual chain smoking, talking about nothing. And I asked my buddy if he believed in the supernatural or paranormal. He gave me an answer I would have expected from him. He said, "Are you high? Why in the hell would I believe in that shit?" He continued to lecture me on why it was stupid, and the only people who believe in stuff like that are hippies and crackheads. But then he did say something else. "Look, I don't believe in demons, ghosts, but evil and demons are the shit we humans do and then blame on evil beings and doings. It's a cop-out to not take accountability of your own shit. You understand?" I thought it was a pretty fair statement. Time passed, and I was updating our range card when we heard a high-pitched noise. "We got movement along the wall," my buddy said. I could make out two figures. Grabbing my night vision goggles, I focused on the figures through the scope. Everything was lit up around them, but the figures only grew darker. I swear the figures were kids, but something was not right. They were running back and forth as if they were playing tag. "We got two along the wall, Tango 3," my partner calls into the hand mic. He then screams from the tower at the figures. "Hey, you! This is a restricted area! Move away from the wall and leave the area immediately!" The figures immediately stopped and stared at us. Now, hearing the frustration in his voice and a little bit of uneasiness, my buddy calls out again, "Hey, you, get the fuck out of here. I'm not playing around." And just like that, the figures completely vanished. Moments passed, and just as things seemed to calm down, we heard that same high-pitched tone again. And we got a call on the radio, but when we called back, all we could hear was uncontrollable laughter saying, "I made it past the wall." Immediately, we panicked. We hailed the next tower, asking if they'd seen anything, but they gave us an annoyed response. "Tango 3, why the hell would anyone be out there? That's a negative." A little short-lived relief comes and goes as another call on the radio comes through with the same laughter. "I made it to your tower," the voice says. We raced to the weapons rack. We hailed the other tower saying, "Shine the light at the base of Tango 3, now." I stood watch at the hatch. The radio called out, "Tango 3, what the hell are we looking for? We might have two unauthorized at the base of Tango 3. As we were waiting for a response from the other tower, we heard something that to this day still rattles me. No more laughter, just a low, deep voice. "I'm in the tower with you now." I raised my weapon to scan the room, only seeing my partner. I didn't dare lower my weapon. There were two figures outside our tower with no facial features, just laughing at us as they dissipated into nothing. Needless to say, the rest of that shift, we were wide awake. Our watch leader scolded us at the end of our shift. He thought we'd made it all up. As soon as we were relieved of our watch, we made our walk back to our tent for rest. A few hours rolled by when we heard incoming sirens and the intercom notifying us of incoming fire. After everything cooled down, we were notified that the tower we had just pulled our shift in was hit by indirect mortar fire and collapsed. Two service members were killed that day.
Whoa. Isn't
that wild?
Mm-hmm. My brain went to such a crazy place when there was the two figures that had no facial features that, you know, called out and then disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And then just because we had just talked about simulation theory,
mm-hmm.
this crazy concept flooded my brain where it's like, okay, like Westworld, the first two seasons.
Yeah. God, I love that show.
I know. Yeah, the first season's so good. Combining that with like simulation theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just thinking like, okay, let's say we are in some kind of game.
Yeah.
And then there's these other beings out there that can play the game.
Right.
And just like Westworld, there's these artificial intelligence robots that they think they're real mm-hmm. or starting to. And then you can buy a ticket to go into this park and interact with them.
Right.
So, and kind of mess with them.
Yeah.
What if like basically in this scenario, all of us here on Earth, we are the Westworld robots.
Ugh.
We are. We like think we're real.
Oh my God! We're just starting to recognize our conscience, our consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, they've given us consciousness. But then somebody can play the game, and they can be a little ghost and fuck with us.
Oh, interesting.
They can make us think we're seeing aliens. They can like change events in the world and just mess with us for their amusement.
Well, that would explain a lot of things in my life.
Yeah. And that, those little two beings that like faded away, to me, like they were the people who had chosen to play the game and were just like messing with the person who's the fan who sent in the story.
I don't know. Military stories always really freak me out. And I feel as though the vast majority of military stories, if not all of them, have come from Afghanistan.
I know. I was just thinking that. And actually, there's ones that Sarah Finch had researched that I haven't like shared yet.
Yeah.
But when you start to like poke around,
yeah,
there are a ton of U.S. military members seeing weird shit, paranormal entities in Afghanistan. Like lots and lots of those stories.
Well, does the jinn come up from Afghanistan? It comes from the Middle East.
That part of the world. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I mean,
it comes from Islam.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I use that word lightly. What makes it fascinating to me is American soldiers, mm-hmm, so just mm-hmm. Americans in foreign lands. They don't necessarily know, like here we're like looking for like Slender Men or like,
you
know.
Oh yeah, you wouldn't know what the local things were.
Exactly. Uh-huh, it's like, uh-huh. You don't know what a djinn is. You don't know what their creatures are. So you seeing something is almost more authentic because it's probably something you've never thought of, you've never seen, you've never heard of, unless you're particularly into horror and the folklore, like worldly folklore. So I don't know, just gives it some more credence, I guess.
That's the programmers. They program different entities for different parts of the world.
We know what your next Nightmare Fuel is going to be all about.
Who knows? One of them, yeah.
But yeah, I really liked all those stories. They were all similar, but different.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a packed episode. That felt like, you know, it's a lot in an hour there, a lot of horror.
Well, you know, listen, we do like listen to the reviews and, you know, the request is to keep the chit chat to the end. You know, it's like, you know, everyone likes a little, what I've gathered is 99% of you enjoy a tiny little breather in between. It's a good place to pause, right? Like if you're going to work, or it's a good place to just, you know, drop off and pick back up.
Like a palate cleanser.
Yeah. And just like a little, if you need a palate cleanser, but like mostly they're here for the horror.
Totally.
And the bonus episodes give us a lot of space to talk freely and for longer bits. And then to talk at the end of the show, because if you don't want it, you can skip it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, if you're just here for the horror, we get it. You hear a story. And then if we talk, I guess there was an episode, sorry about this. We talked for something like 17 minutes in between stories. And we must have gone off on a tangent.
Yeah. That must've been a rare one.
It was super rare, but a valid complaint. Yeah, yeah. I was like, yeah, I'd be annoyed too. And, you know, so it's like, you're skipping forward. Yeah. And then like, you know, if you enter a story.
Totally.
So it's like, we get it. We're aware. We're not going to, you know, change the format of the show, but we can be conscious. And so it's like,
I rein back the, you know, early part of the show announcements on TimeSuck.
Yeah.
A lot of episodes now I have, you know, one small one or none.
Yeah.
And I've seen more reviews reflect that too, where they're like, man, episodes have been tight lately.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I think sometimes like any job, you kind of like, you do it long enough, you forget why people liked the work you were doing initially.
Right,
and you're like, oh yeah, a little reminder. Yeah.
They're here for the stories. And like, you know, we're realistic. Not everybody can afford like ad-free episodes. That's not an option for everyone. And with all the content out there, it's like you're trying to consume so much. So it's like if you're someone who's not paying for ad-free episodes, totally, like get it. Now you've got to fast forward through ads.
Totally.
And us chatting. I can completely respect why it gets frustrating. What did we just watch recently that we had freaking ads in?
Yeah, we just weren't expecting it. It was the eyelashes of Tammy Faye. The eyes of Tammy Faye.
Tammy Faye's eyelashes.
But really good movie.
Really good. Jessica Chastain. Excellent.
I was just thrown because I forgot that on Hulu and maybe some of the other platforms, obviously you pay for the streaming service.
Yeah.
And then you get used to like no commercials in because you're paying.
Mm-hmm.
And then every once in a while, the rights they have with some movie is that they also still have to have ads. You're like, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but for me, it was a good reminder of like, oh yeah, it's annoying.
Yeah.
And those you can't fast forward through. They're sort of like those ads that pop up when you're watching something on YouTube. Those like 15 or 30 second ads that you have to wait until it gets to a certain point before you can fast forward through. So yeah, thanks. Thank you always for like the respectful feedback.
Yeah, totally. It helps us. We want the show to be good so we can keep doing it.
Totally. And when you're a dick, that's not like, that's not constructive criticism. That's not helpful in any way.
Yeah,
but like when you send an email of like, hey, I enjoy the show. Did you know on this episode you talked for 17 minutes?
Fair.
I went back and I emailed them. I was like, sorry about that. But like, that's fixable, you know? And you want to fix it, right? It's like any relationship. You're like, when you come to me with kindness, I want to work on it. When you just accuse me of being a dick, I don't, fuck you. You know, you're reactionary. Mm-hmm. So, all right, do you want to do some shout outs?
I would love to.
Go, bro.
I would like to thank the following Annabelles for supporting what we do here and keeping this train on the tracks.
Yes.
Brittany Kalino. Yeah, there we go. Brittany Kalino. Junie Libby. Alexandra Padilla. Garrett Tremea. Eric Fote. Stacey Berry. Taylor Graves. T. Branson. Heidi and Elijah Bryant. You know, I forget about the name Elijah.
It's a good name.
Fun name.
Mm-hmm. When you said Garrett Tremea, I immediately went into the Tremé.
Oh, haha, yeah.
Yeah. Great HBO show if you haven't watched it. So good. And in our favorite city.
Yep, it's a great show.
Yeah. God, love it. Okay. I'd like to thank the following Annabelles as well for supporting us here and all that we do. Sam, Are You Voodoo? Laura Broussard. Sydney Spencer, Mariah Prokoska, Mariah Prokoska, Brenda Velasco, McKenna Coppinger, Donna Merrill Klassen, Tracy Hill, and Ruben Adams. I really got those last two.
Yeah, you nailed them.
I feel like I crushed it. Okay, and then I just have a few spoopy shout-outs.
Okay.
To Nicole from Crystal. Happy birthday. You are the light of my life. You mean the world to me. Thank you for all you do and your never-ending support of this single mom and her space newt. Oh, I love the love between two girlfriends. It's very different than two dudes, but it's like so sweet. To Lola from Amelia. I love you and I'll miss you always. Amelia had to put her dog Lola down recently and unexpectedly. And to Nikki from Sierra, thank you for being not only the best mom, but my best friend and my rock. Happy birthday. I love you more.
Aww.
I know, so sweet.
And that is our show. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else, info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. Thank you to Logan Keith, editing and publishing today's show, scoring as well. Thank you to Heather Rylander for organizing the My Story emails, to book editor Drew Atana, polishing and preparing listener stories for book number 5. Big thanks to producer Molly Jean Box for finding both stories I told this week. We are on YouTube if you'd like to watch this show. We're on Facebook and Instagram where we post pics that accompany episodes and more at Scared to Death Podcast. We have a private Facebook group called Creeps and Peepers that is a blast. Big thanks to the All-Seeing Eyes, the Creeps and Peepers moderators. Thank you for continuing to be fantastic. And enjoy your nightmares, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but have no home here within. Scared to death.
Mad Magic Productions.
Ah, AI.
Yeah.
CGI.
You'd have to start murdering me or something. Like something really aggressive would have to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a deep fake.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.